Good morning, everybody.
Good
morning, Drew.
Good morning.
If this recording, pardon me, didn't work? Oh, cable. The cable was upset with me.
Oh, June Allison.
I think it's a cable pinch. Yeah, the picture was looking like it had jaundice for a while there, and that was kind of a problem. Pardon me?
You had that last week.
I did have that problem last week, and I need to take it to a doctor. have its iron checked. Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Since this may be recorded, our last recording didn't work. There was a flaw in the disc, so I'm going to repeat some of the things. But first of all, my name is Mark Perez. This is the Paradoxes class. What's the date today?
August 16, 2015.
And our subject today is what is worldview. And this is our third session. Remember early on in the first session, we were trying to take odds on what were the chances that we would succeed in getting through the class on any one session. And they were really low. They were in orders of magnitude below, like 0.105 or something like that. So where are we and what are we going to be doing today? Well, Lord willing, in the next 45 minutes, we're going to review part of what we went through before, and then we're going to ask the question, or answer the question, is there a way to compare worldviews in an objective way? And to determine whether one or another or any series of them might be superior to the others. So let's look really quickly at what we meant by a worldview definition. And we said that we were going to accept this definition as a working definition for this session, which is that a worldview is the set of beliefs about fundamental aspects of reality that ground and influence all of what we perceive and think and know and do. And then we asked, where do worldviews come from? All of these and more, but there's one on here that wasn't here last time. Can you figure out which one it is?
Physiology.
Thank you. Good. That was you did that really fast. Why do you think that got included this time and it wasn't last time?
Found out something about yourself?
Yeah, I did. I found I have physiology somewhere in my body. I still can't find it yet completely. No, I was talking with Ross Hoagland, my fellow philosopher, and he said, you know, our physiology controls so much of what we think and what we do and what we perceive. Just think of the man-woman difference. Do men and women look at the world differently?
Yes.
Of course they do. And there's differences among people of the same sex, but there's huge differences between men and women. I'm here to tell you that. Look, trust me on that.
No,
well, I think it's still true. I think it's still true, and it would be a good debate, but we're going to accept that for right now as a Christian worldview and say that our physiology actually does. And you can think about other aspects of our physiology, not just what sex we are, but the other things that work on us to make us different. If you can't hear, can you have the same worldview that somebody who does here? Well, they're going to have different experiences. It's a different world. All right, so the most important of these we talked about was the emotionally evocative events. Why? Why are emotionally evocative events so powerful and have such salience in the question of adopting and creating and understanding worldviews? Why would they? Amy. Thank you. So we engage in something that happens to us and it changes us because of an emotional event. Thank you. Please.
A lot of emotional events are things that are threatening to your survival.
Yes.
Over the eons, we have come to recognize, wow, when that's bad, it's, you know, it's imprinted very strongly in the mind.
So, emotional events tied to things that are a threat to us,
yeah,
imprint in a deep way that affects our worldview.
Right.
Thank you. Tim?
I know more than a few times I've heard of Christians or former Christians saying they've seen babies suffering and have thus given up the Christian religion. That's a big thing I've seen.
Yes.
Babies suffering.
Yes.
That image of a baby and suffering. Yeah.
Very emotional if it strikes you. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
That's what I was going to say. I know people that have had negative emotions that, like he was saying, blocks you towards God because you think, how could God allow some of those, like, baby stuff?
Yes.
That's what turns a lot of people away from God.
Yes, is they have these emotional events and they negative. Can't reconcile negative ones that they can't reconcile with the existence of God. And so that dramatically influences the worldview, doesn't it? What else? One more, please.
Oh, I don't know if it's good, but I was thinking on the reverse side of the same thing. They say there's no atheists in Foxhole. So they see a lot of stuff like it too, but they, I mean, you know, look towards help. So it's the same side of a different
side. It is. It's a different side. Certainly the idea that there are no atheists in Foxholes is the other side of the same coin. Yeah, it's a very emotionally evocative event to have people trying to put bullets in you or bombs or whatever else. And so your emotions can get very influential as to what kind of a worldview you're going to have then. Are all the things that you were taught in the past about the existence of God and his ability to work in a battle come to fruition then? Yes. Thank you. Well, we can go on and talk more about emotionally evocative events, but the reason that we want to settle on that here when we look at the worldviews is that we have to be conscious that it is so powerful that when we look at analyzing worldviews, we want to use objective, cognitive means to assess them. But we cannot ignore the emotions. As a matter of fact, if we even think of ignoring the emotions, we've missed the point. Because ultimately, knowing about worldviews is all about how are we going to share the gospel of Christ with people who don't know Christ, and for some people who can't know Christ without bridging that gap. Ultimately, that's what this is about. Then the next question we dealt with was, what are the elements of a worldview? And then we had all sorts of ologies up here.
Epistemology.
Good. Keep going, Steve. How about cosmology?
Cosmology, God. Theology.
Good. How about the one that has to deal with God?
Theology.
Theology, good, thank you. And how about the one that has to deal with man?
Anthropology,
good. And then the one that tells us, what are we looking at when we go outside of physics?
Cosmology,
good. There's another one that takes us above physics. Think of Greek word meta and above physics.
Metaphysics,
good. And then the last one, the things that we think about axiomatically, what kind of an ology would you get out of that?
Axiology,
brilliant. Steve, you got all of them. Thank you. Excellent. Axiology you hardly ever hear because it's only philosophers like to use it. But I'll go through them really quickly here. Epistemology is beliefs about the nature and sources of knowledge. And we agreed that would go first because it really is prior. If you don't know what you know and why you know it and how you establish your beliefs, nothing else much matters. Metaphysics is what is the ultimate nature of reality? That's what we're talking about when we talk about metaphysics. And I'm going through this quickly because we've already gone through it twice and I don't want to wear you out. But I do want to help remind you of it. Now this time I changed something on the slide again. What did I do?
Not capitalized.
Say it again, Mark.
It's not capitalized.
You're right. You caught it. Why did I change it? Because I changed my worldview. That's right. I had an emotionally evocative event, and it made me do it. No, the reason I changed it was I remember us having a discussion here about cosmology with a capital C and cosmology with a small c. So I thought, well, it would be most appropriate to not put the capital C here and create an ambiguity. So what we're talking about here is cosmology with a little c, with a small c. And that is the nature and the order of the universe and all it contains. And by the way, that definition is different from the last time. Mark is checking his notes to verify that, but I can tell you that it is different, slightly different. And we're talking about the nature of the order of the universe and all it contains. And the reason I did that is because we got into a Greek discussion on what is cosmos to the Greeks and how do we get the word cosmology to begin with. So this isn't just about space, it's about all of the order of the universe, including the planets and the earth and the humanity.
Especially origins.
Thank you. Teleology is all about purpose. Every person has some theory about the purpose of the cosmos, the purpose of everything that is. And this one we were asking, is there any reason or purpose for the cosmos? Is there a reason for existence? In the sermon today, the pastor was even talking about that. He says the person who wrote the book confronted somebody who's having these deep existential questions, like, is it really a purpose, or do I just have a bad day some days and a good day other days? Or is there over the long haul, is there a reason for all of this? That's what teleology asks. The next one is theology. That's pretty much straightforward. That's the existence and nature of a god or gods. Questions like, who is God? Is there a God? Is there only one God? Or is there a whole committee of gods? What do we have? A pantheon? A single-year God? And then we have anthropology, which isn't just the ancient study of bones and cultures and civilizations, but it's really the study of humanity as humanity. Anthropos means, in Greek, man, but man as humanity. So it's the study of mankind, of humanity, and what is the nature of humanity? And then last is axiology. And axiology is the nature and study of values. And values like, what is the highest good? What matters? Why does it matter? Does anything matter? Can we put the value on human life because it's practical? Or do we put a value on human life because there's something intrinsically good? For the Christian, what's the answer to the question? Why do we value life?
God created it.
God made us in His image. And He told us, I'm placing the value on life. Life, therefore, has an intrinsic value, above and beyond any kind of service or product you can derive from the person. Is that the same thing for a humanist? No. Man may be the measure of all things, but man doesn't have an intrinsic value. He has a practical value. And then different humanists go into all sorts of different philosophies like utilitarianism and pragmatism and all these other isms. So, axiology is asking the question, or is the discussion of the question, what do we value and how do we achieve those values? So why do we care about these elements? Why should we care? Yes. Absolutely. I told you originally, I didn't really expect everybody to memorize them, although Steve, fantastic job.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for contributing. I really appreciate that, and so do the rest of us, by the way. So, if we understand what these elements are, and we understand that they exist, it at least gives us an idea that there is a structure to the way of thinking and the ways of thinking that create a worldview. And it's important for us to understand what the elements of the structure is, or what the elements are of that structure, in order to be able to really appreciate when somebody says something, where might that fit in? Is that kind of something about the theory of knowledge, or is that a values question, or is this something about the nature of humanity? So forth. And when you ask those questions, by the way, you ask yourself, how does the Christian worldview distinguish itself from this other worldview. Because ultimately we have to compare. As you'll see when we're getting into the comparisons and how do we determine which one's which or which one's best, we're going to have to know what questions to ask. We asked the question, should we care what worldview another person holds? And we agreed, yes, we definitely have to care. Because what's our mission?
Convince them of ours.
Not, well, it can convince them of ours. That's one way of looking at it. Our mission really, if we're going to kind of break that down into its component pieces, the most essential part of that worldview is to present the gospel of Christ to a group of people who are lost, which is about everybody in the world who isn't a Christian. Okay? So we as assistant shepherds are trying to bring together a flock and to find those that are lost. That's our job, to bring the gospel of Christ to a world that's lost. Then the question, can another's worldview be changed? If we go back to the things that create worldviews, what was the one that was in red? Emotionally evocative events. We already were able to show that emotionally evocative events can change a worldview and can frame a worldview. Then the last question we asked in our review was, can any worldview be shown to be the best? Now, is that slide different than last week? It is.
Superior,
yes. You're right. You're right, Carol. You are just incredible. You're my assistant, too. I got two assistants now. The front row does it, yeah. There's something about that. I'm just getting all sorts of energy. It did say superior, and you know what? Somebody came up to me during or after the class and said, do you really want to say that? Do you really want to say that our worldview is superior to others?
Yes, because we're very humble.
And that was the point the person was making, was it sounds like not that our worldview is superior to other worldviews, but that we are better to them. And I said, I'm not sure I buy that, but I'm willing to change the language because it doesn't really matter. Because I really am focusing on what the worldview is. So if it bothered somebody that we used the word superior, and I couldn't conceive of it the way it was being presented to me, but I could at least understand it. And I thought, well, I really don't want to make it look like I'm better than you, because I'm not. Or that we are better than anybody else, because we aren't. But is our worldview the best? That one we can argue, because it's not me versus you. It's that worldview versus another. Please.
I would almost say superior is not strong enough because it says better, whereas God says actually best because it's the truth.
Thank you. So superior is better than another. It's relative, but the best is absolute. Mm-hmm. Could put Excelsior or something like that up there. Ever higher? John, please.
You can also ask if a worldview can be consistent with all reality.
Oh, that's a good measure. That's a very good measure. As a matter of fact, we're going to see that in a couple of minutes. That measure will show up. Thank you. So, are there tests for worldviews? Well, the answer is yes. I'm borrowing this material from Ken Samples from Reasons to Believe. He has a book called A World of Difference. If you haven't read the book, A World of Difference, it's very easy to read. It's a very easy to read book. It gets into worldviews and it makes a lot of interesting statements about them. He also has a really excellent discussion, the best discussion I've ever seen in such a short amount of text on postmodernism. Postmodernism is hard to put your fingers on. He did a great job doing that. So I encourage you to read his book. I don't get any money off of this, so I'm not pimping this to make my own money off of this. But he does it really well. He does it really well. And these are the nine tests for truth. Now, as we go through this, I want to tell you something about the nature of a worldview and some other words that might belong to that. As I was looking at the way Ken Samples analyzed this, I was asking myself the question, Can we use another word to describe a worldview? Is the way we assess a worldview similar to the way we assess something else? And I thought, yeah, actually, when you start looking at some of the words like coherence, parsimony, explanatory power, and scope, the first thing that popped in my mind was this is very much like how we assess scientific theories. Matter of fact, it's almost exactly, except for a couple of features at the end, you'll see are different. So the question to ask is, when we think of a worldview, can we assess it the way we assess a theory? Is a worldview a theory? Is it a theory? In the richest sense of the word theory, like a scientific theory. Is it testable? Sure. Can we compare it with others? And, as we'll see here, the question, can we compare it in objective ways? The answer is yes. So you can think of a worldview if you want. If you don't want to think of it personally, you can actually think about it theoretically as a comparison of two different theories. And this works really well for brainy, smurfy people who like to deal with theoretical things. You know, you get somebody who says, I don't want to talk that worldview stuff. That's all a bunch of emotional, evocative stuff. Well, no, actually, I would like to compare your theory with the Christian theory in an objective way, in ways that you and I and everybody else can look at and say, true or false? Yes or no? Up or down? The best or not? So let's start with coherence. Is the worldview, like a theory, logically consistent? So what does that even mean? What do you think we mean by a worldview being logically consistent? Ross?
I guess the first thing that comes to my mind is it self-defeating in any way? As it stands, is there anything in it that is logically inconsistent within itself?
Thank you. Is there anything within it logically inconsistent? So that's sort of the opposite way of looking at it, and then coming to the conclusion by looking at what it isn't. So let's ask this question. Go back in your mind to the slides very close to the beginning, where we had somebody who said something along the lines of, there's no truth. Help me with that one. Is that logically consistent? Why not? Why is it not consistent to say there is no truth? Right. It's self-defeating, it's self-referentially absurd, you can use all sorts of different terminology for it. But the point is, if it's true, it's false. If it's false, it's false. So, I mean, any way you look at it, it's not going to work. So, that's one example of coherence, or incoherence, if you will, is that if I hold a worldview which, when it makes its positions known, are in themselves absurd, either in practice or in theory, It's not a consistent or coherent worldview. That's logical consistency. Logical. That's different from practical, and we'll get into that in a bit. Tim, please.
I just have a question.
Yes, sir.
Can that worldview still be valid?
Can the worldview be valid?
Can someone go through their life living that worldview? Could they still be Christian?
Just because it's not logically consistent, what other consequences are there?
I'm just thinking if there's loads of people out there who have this worldview.
Well, there are loads of people who have that worldview, but here's the question. Let's say they do have a logically inconsistent worldview. What are the consequences of that? And, so that's one question. The other question is the one that we first started to ask when we got into this. Could it be considered the best worldview if it is logically inconsistent? And there's another one, all other things being equal, that is logically consistent. See, so in one, can you live a logically inconsistent life? Yeah, you can, because you don't suddenly drop dead from being logically inconsistent.
You can live in more pain and hurt more people.
Yeah, well, it will cause more pain. It'll cause all sorts of stuff. And it causes really ridiculous consequences in the extreme in some cases. The Think of the logical inconsistency in some laws. In California, for example, there is a law called the Therapeutic Abortion Act. And that's in one section of the 50-something codes of California. And then there's another law, Section 187 of the Penal Code, called murder. So if I attack a woman who is pregnant and her baby dies, is that murder in California? Yes, it is. Under 187 of the Penal Code, it's murder. However, if I'm a doctor and I kill her baby with the mom's consent, is it murder? No, it is not. The Therapeutic Abortion Act says it isn't. So in one case, the same baby is considered authorized to live and another one authorized to kill. Is that logically consistent? You can make some really interesting arguments based on the law and say, well, this law governs that. But my point is, not to justify one position or another, but just to show how logical inconsistency can create some very perverse outcomes. And then we get into axiology. What do we value? Then we get into anthropology. What is the nature of humanity anyway? At what point are you a person? You see how it's starting to click now? Anthropology kicks in. And then we ask questions like, if that's not logically consistent, that the same person can be considered eligible for death and eligible for life just because two different people are the ones making the decision. Not due process, mind you. This isn't the question of somebody being convicted of a crime. This is a person who has not done a thing. There is a logical inconsistency there that arises from a worldview or a system of worldviews. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about, is the worldview logically consistent? I have to get through the rest of them. I have see people have their hands up. They would love to chat, and I would love to engage you, but I have to move on. Because this time, I think we're going to have a 100% chance of finishing. Parsimony. Parsimony is a phrase that's used in assessing theories, and it's kind of a strange term because it doesn't sound like what it should be. But the balance test is as complex and as simple as necessary. It's a kind of application of Occam's razor to worldviews. And Occam's razor is basically the statement of William of Ockham that was particularly longer than what I'm about to state it as, but is you don't add unnecessary features to a theory when you don't need to, and you make sure all that you need to have is present. Okay, so the theory should have all but only what's required to make the theory work. So a worldview should have all but only what it takes to make it work. Adding anything more to it, and the question is, why do you have it? It's probably the least important of all of them, because you are going to, at any time, have more than you need because you don't know whether it's true. So I'm not going to go any further than that. That would be a long philosophical discussion. But the next one is probably the one that's easiest to assess and the one that Christians have the greatest opportunity with, and that is the one about explanatory power and scope. Does it explain a broad enough scope of phenomena, and does it do so in sufficient detail? Every time Hugh Ross comes up in front of his class, he is making statements about phenomena. Is he not?
Yes.
Yes, he is. Thank you. And he's also saying that the Bible would predict some of these, or they're at least capable, the Bible is at least consistent with these, and that these phenomena and the evidence for them is inconsistent with something else, with another worldview. So the question is, do we have enough explanatory power? Does the Bible, for example, explain enough things to be able to live a life from? And are they accurate and in sufficient detail to be able to use them for a well-lived life.
Yes.
And a worldview that is not just to live morally and correctly, but practically. So that is the question. And when we look at other worldviews, we get to ask that question of them as well. Ross, did you want to say something?
Yes, sir.
So I'm going to repeat this for the audience and the internet. The question was, did Ken Sample say, does it explain a broad scope of phenomena instead of all phenomena? And should the standard be it explains all phenomena? Well, are we ever conscious or capable of even engaging all phenomena?
No.
There's a practical limitation to it. But broad enough, because we have that inductive problem. We don't know the future. We can't access the future, at least in sufficient detail to be able to explain it. So that it makes sense to have a test or an assessment or a method that says we're just looking for the broadest scope. So if I have a worldview that has a very narrow scope, and I'm comparing it with another worldview that has this much, much broader scope, it explains many, many more kinds of phenomena. All other things being equal, which of the two would you rather have? The broader one. Would it be better than the other one?
Yes.
Well, yeah, because you're able to use it more effectively. Amy?
So I'm guessing a good example of a worldview that has a very strong, broad scope of phenomena explanation would be the sort of the Christian Scientist worldview, the idea of combining the knowledge that we've
when you say Christian Scientist, you mean Christian with a capital C and Scientist with a small s?
Yeah.
So not the Christian Science as a religion.
No.
But Christians who are scientists.
Right.
Yes.
Like Hugh Ross
and others, yeah. So the question is that worldview the kind that would give us that kind of broad explanatory power? Answer is yes. Thank you. Three more tests. Correspondence. Does the worldview correspond with the way the world really is? When I was thinking about what we're going to do for the class, I was going to have the people turn to each other in groups and discuss this question after I give you an example. No way we're going to have time for that. Even though it would be interesting to hear what you had to say, and maybe that will be another day, we can just kind of pinpoint a couple of these and work them through really, really well. But for today, just to understand what we're talking about when we're talking about a correspondence worldview, we're talking about, or the correspondence standard of a worldview, is does this worldview correspond with the way the world really is, in fact, and in human experience? So let's look at one worldview, the worldview of one particular worldview of humanism that says humans are, they start out good and are good people until they're taught to be otherwise. And then let's compare that with the Christian worldview, which says people are start out evil, sinful, and will keep being that way forever until there's some way to restrain them.
Humanists obviously did not have children.
The humans didn't have children, yes. Hasn't figured out how humans really work.
They were demonstrating that.
Yes. So you have two worldviews there. Can the humanist worldview really answer, does it really correspond to the way people are? Are people really good from the beginning of their life onward until they're trained to be bad?
No.
Not if you're honest. So that's what we're talking about. There are all sorts of different worldviews. My point is, that's what we're talking about with correspondence. That was just an example. Verification. This is a fun one. Can its claims be verified or falsified? In science, generally speaking, a theory is considered ineffective if there's no way to falsify it. In other words, if you can't prove that theory is wrong, or, on the other hand, prove that it's probably right, more probably than not right, then what good is it? So the same thing applies with, if we're going to use that theoretical metaphor for a worldview, can I verify that the claims that the worldview make are true? So let's go back to the example of people who are born are good until the world does them in. Now, I haven't quite figured out how they explain, and they never have explained, how the world got this way.
Yeah.
But leave that as it is. Can we verify? Can we look at statistics or objective phenomena that we both agree on, the data, and come to a conclusion to verify or falsify the theory? Yeah. Now, I'm not going to argue it here whether, you know, one view or the other is better or not for this case. I just want to show you that's what we're talking about when we're talking about falsification, or in this case, verification. Can its claims be verified? Number six, pragmatics. Is it socially and individually workable in real life? I would argue that this would not show up in an assessment of most scientific theories. But that could be argued. But notwithstanding that, for a worldview, if you can't use it, why have it? So can one worldview be more pragmatic and effective than another? Sure. If I hold the worldview that people are intrinsically good and I keep creating laws that don't work, is that pragmatically ineffective? Yeah. Yes. There are many other ways of looking at it pragmatically, but since we only have 10 minutes, we have to kind of trim down the things that we're going to talk about. Now here we're getting into a little bit less of the scientific aspect of it, the existential satisfaction. Again, let's go back to the homily that the pastor gave us today about the existential question this guy was having about meaning in life. If I believe that the universe is all there is, all there was, and all there will ever be, and there is nothing else but matter, space, time, and energy, and I really believe that, is that existentially satisfying to know that when I'm dead, everything I was and everything I could have been is extinguished forever, and it's as if I never lived?
Doesn't matter.
Who gives a flopping fish, right? You're just gone. You're just now vapor. As a matter of fact, it's kind of stupid to even talk about you, because the only you that's left is the you that's in people's memories, or that may have been written down and people can look at and refer to, and if you wait long enough, it won't matter then either. So how existentially satisfying is that form of a worldview? Ultimately, the question Tim asks, can you still have an incoherent worldview and still live? Yeah, you can.
Not very well.
Not very well. And if you look at the kinds of things that happen to people who push this to an extreme, can you imagine the most extreme example of somebody who runs into an existential crisis? What is it? Suicide. Yeah, because there's no meaning to life. Now, not everybody who has this worldview goes and commits suicide. Suicide rate's pretty obviously not that high. But when you run into people who do kill themselves, it very frequently is because they say, why am I here? Pain's too much. There's no reason for being here. There's no end beyond the pain. There's no end beyond why this suffering seems to be happening. Gentlemen, I see the hands. I'm not gonna entertain them right now. I'm sorry. And lady, if there was other people too. Cumulative reliability. Do multiple lines of evidence accumulate to justify the worldview? When Hugh Ross comes up in front of this class, does he only talk about cosmology? No. What else does he talk about?
Theology.
Theology. biology, chemistry, geology, atmospheric physics, all sorts of things. These are all different lines of evidence. These are all the different things he's saying. If you look at all of these things and integrate them, do they accumulate, as it says here, to justify a worldview? Well, that's his whole purpose in doing what he's doing.
Yeah.
Is to integrate all of these different lines of evidence to justify the Christian worldview. And now he's not trying to make that the only justification. He's saying if we're going to look at those things, they do justify it as far as they go. They're not comprehensive justification. They are not. They're only part of it. He uses the term, there's the record of nature, and then there's a record of Scripture. You need them both. You can't just rely on the record of nature. But the record of nature, if it's accurately determined, and the record of Scripture, if it's accurately read, will harmonize. So you get these different lines of evidence. They should all connect up in a way that accumulates to show the justification of a worldview from that perspective. And the last one is competitive competence. Is it able to compete with others? And, as it says at the end here, to adapt to new discoveries. Adapt to new discoveries. Hugh says it all the time. He says, hey, you know what? As we've worked on our model, our creation science model, our testable creation model, he says, hey, we've had to adjust it. Okay, is that kind of a worldview a reasonable worldview? At least given all other things being the same. If I have a worldview that absolutely is totally inflexible, if I can't come up and find new knowledge and then say, maybe what I thought before wasn't true, what kind of a worldview is that? It's a worldview that's going to be a problem. If you're totally inflexible and you say, what I know today is all I will ever know. Pardon me? It would be very fragile. Yes, thank you. That's a really good way of putting it. It would be a very fragile worldview because none of us is omniscient. And so we will necessarily have to make adaptations or adjustments. Think about people who are not Christians. Do they have to make adaptations if they're going to become Christians? Whole cloth. Their whole worldview changes. A little at a time, maybe, or maybe completely as one giant fracture. But doesn't really matter. Any worldview that's going to be a right worldview is going to have to be able to adapt as we learn new things. It's extremely important. And for many of us as Christians, we need to realize that we do have to adapt. That we do not know everything. We do not know everything theologically, and we certainly don't know everything scientifically. The Bible tells us to be humble, and there's a reason. And we have to be humble in our worldviews, too. In that respect. So if a worldview were incapable of that kind of flexibility, then we would say it would not be very competent to compete with others that do have that flexibility. Now the question is, do you think Christianity is that flexible? I think so for some people, yes. Now if the whole purpose in us having this discussion, spending 3 weeks asking questions about what are worldviews? What's the definition of a worldview? What are the elements of a worldview? And how do we assess it? Is to mean anything? In the end, it's going to have to mean that we're going to need to look at things in a different way. And realize that other people can look at exactly the same thing we're looking at and see something totally different. And we have to appreciate that. Just like this image that's up in front of you here. What is that? It's a duck if you look at it one way, and it's a rabbit if you look at it another way. So, you know, here's the duck. Here's the duck's bill. He's looking out that way. If it's a rabbit, he's looking this way, and there's his ears. Okay. Yeah, so that's kind of fun. I mean, it gives you the idea that you can, a whole bunch of people can look at exactly the same thing. Everybody's looking at the same thing here. And the first thing that pops to your mind, I have two different things that people are saying. Oh, it's a rabbit. No, it's a duck. No, it's a rabbit. It's a duck. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, it really is a duck. Well, no, maybe it's a rab duck. Okay. So these kinds of things are all over the place. I mean, here's another one. I'm sure we've all seen this one. This one is the what? The old woman and the young woman. Okay, the old woman, here's her eyes, her mouth. I'm doing this because some people aren't seeing the old woman. And the young woman, here's her eyes looking out that way, her hair, little thing sticking out the bouffant. Yeah, and this is really to show when you listen to people, I mean, just listen in this room how quickly people came to a quick judgment. You saw one or the other first. Or if you've seen this before, you knew what it was. But if you hadn't seen it before, and some people didn't, they came, snap decision. Why would I even bother showing you this? Well, it's partly to show how quickly we will make a judgment based on what we see and how different the judgments are with exactly the same data with people who have roughly the same worldview. How we differ so quickly in making a judgment. And the last thing is this, that what our worldview does, all that we value and all that we think, begins and ends with our worldview. This is exactly true for everybody. Not just the people in this room, but everybody on the planet. So worldviews have a huge effect because we can't do without them. As a matter of fact, we don't do without them. Our worldviews are all that we think and value, and begins and ends with those worldviews. What are your questions for the next 14 seconds? Russ.
Real quick, I'll say there's no such thing as a single monolithic Christian worldview. That, you know, whether you have a young earth or old earth perspective, or whether you have a free will or predestination perspective, those things can create very, very different worldviews within Christianity.
Yes, and we did talk about that a couple of weeks ago, where we talked about, is it possible that there are as many worldviews as there are people? The answer is, yeah, it could be. And so you're right, and it's very important for us to capture that.
But not on the essentials.
Not on the essentials. And so when we look at axiology, anthropology, etc., is there a fundamental, basic worldview that the Bible expresses? And the answer is yes. Are there places where we would differ? Yeah. Do I sprinkle the baby and call that a baptism, or do I immerse somebody in water after they say they repented? Those are both baptism, but is either one going to change the way whether you go to heaven or not go to heaven? Jesus didn't say you're going to hell if you don't get baptized. So we have to be very careful that, yes, there are different worldviews within Christianity, but there is one Christian worldview that is controlled by its fundamentals. What's clearest in the Bible is what's most important in the Bible. What isn't so clear, we don't worry about. We can contest it and we can argue it. We are out of time. So all 14 seconds, you guys had that plenty of opportunity to ask questions. You guys just didn't do it well. You guys are really inefficient.
We could use another week.
Yeah, we could use another week. So let me close this in prayer, and then we'll hand it up. Okay.
All right. I get hammered with a lot of stuff, and I had a very important prayer request, and I forgot it just in the midst of all of the thing. I didn't know that Steve was coming today, so it kind of caught me off guard. I got an email, and you got the email also. We want to pray for Warren. Warren is in the hospital, and it's serious. And Nancy, of course, his wife, very loyal members of the class and of LA chapter. And so she obviously, needless to say, is very worried about her husband, and would ask the class as a whole that we would pray for him. He has a serious infection and possibly some other medical issues they're discovering, because when you're in the hospital, they start probing around and they find other things, and so that, you know, made her worries even better. So do you want to pray for them?
I would be very happy to do
that. You could close in prayer and also pray, since you know them both very well also.
Yes, thank you very much. Lord, thank you for this time. We praise you for all of the things that you give us in our minds and in our hearts, the worldview that you've allowed us to have, and the wisdom to be able to alter it and to see others as well. We pray especially, Lord, for Warren and Nancy. Warren, who's in the hospital, and Nancy, who's praying her way through this, that you would heal Warren. Work with him. Work through him. Work through the doctors to restore him back to whatever he was before that, Lord, in a way that the world can see and that would glorify you. Give us wisdom in helping Nancy, to be gracious with her. Help us, Lord, when we talk to her, to listen and to feel with her. And to remember your verse that says to weep with those who weep. and to rejoice with those who rejoice. We don't have to do any more than that, Lord. We just have to be able to do that. Give us peace, Lord, as we go out into the world, and let us look at all the rest of the world as a bunch of people who need you, who want you and don't even know it. And may we be respectful of every one of them and treat them with grace as we go about our work. Thank you, Lord, in Christ's name. Amen.
Thank you, everybody.